The following podcast is provided to you free, as is all our content, at drhoffman.com. If you'd like to listen, help support Intelligent Medicine, and get great values by shopping at our supplement store, go to drhoffman.com and click on Shop, then click on the store. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast. Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today's subject is high blood pressure, hypertension. Our guest is Dr. Kathy Padgett, known to her patients simply as Dr. Kathy. She practices in northeastern Ohio at the Center for Lifestyle Change. Dr. Padgett, you know, your population is probably a little different than my population. I practice in Midtown Manhattan. Describe the community that you live in, because, you know, maybe it's a little different than Midtown Manhattan in terms of the proportion of people who perhaps are less oriented towards a healthy lifestyle.
Well, I live in northeastern Ohio. Primarily, it's more blue collar than white collar still. And there's a high degree of obesity. It probably is higher than, national average. You know, approximately, 65% of people in the United States now are overweight or obese. You know, we probably topped that number a little bit. It's probably closer to 75-80%, I would say.
Wow.
So it is, but, you know, I think there's been a growing trend for people to understand that you can make some lifestyle modifications and control disease. I think what's helped that a lot is actually the internet. I think that's one thing the internet's been great for. People have much more knowledge about that. If they haven't found it for themselves, their families, you know, their grandchildren, their children have been more than happy to tell them, well, hey, I looked up your disease.
Right.
On where them being, you know, there's things you could be doing for that.
Right.
So it's actually been a pretty decent teaching tool in some respects.
Well, in part one, you described your own lifestyle approach, which is you embrace a vegan dietary approach. How does that sit well with the inhabitants of northeastern Ohio, who are perhaps a little less committed, less sophisticated from a dietary standpoint, maybe less willing to make that kind of sea change in their eating habits?
No, you know, I don't necessarily try to put everyone on a plant-based diet. I think you have to actually evaluate people from where they are. I do try to get them off a standard American diet, and I do try to help them transition on to either the DASH diet. And the DASH diet was actually designed for patients with hypertension. It is sanctioned by the American Society of Hypertension. And interestingly enough, what was found was that if you followed a DASH diet, which really is just a diet that's high in fruits, vegetables, low-fat dairy products, and a reduced amount of saturated fat and animal fat, and you can lower systolic blood pressure, the upper number of blood pressure, by about 11 millimeters of mercury, which is pretty impressive considering initiation of a new medication will get you somewhere usually in the 5 to 10 point range.
So it's almost double the response. A diet provides double the response that certain medications do. And it also carries additional benefits, reduces the risk of other health problems and even cancer. So, you know, without adverse side effects, except maybe for a little deprivation.
Yeah. And, you know, the other diet, of course, has gotten a lot of media attention, is a Mediterranean-style diet. And a Mediterranean-style diet has also been shown to lower blood pressure, somewhere probably in the neighborhood of 3 to 5 millimeters of mercury. And it, too, has been shown to lower the risk of cancer, cardiovascular disease. And really, if you look at the HALE study, the Healthy Aging Longitudinal neat longitudinal study in Europe. They looked at people from 70 to 90 years old, and they had a 50% lower rate of all-cause mortality and morbidity. So either diet, if I can transition patients onto that, and if I can try to transition them on to replacing processed oils with olive oil, which has also been shown to cause lead to reductions in systolic blood pressure somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 to 7 millimeters of mercury, and get them to add some fiber, I think we're doing pretty darn well.
Are you at times concerned about the permissiveness of those diets to complex carbohydrates, which for some people are well tolerated, but for others they're very carbohydrate sensitive? Do you have to sometimes rein in their intake of, quote, whole grains, because they might interpret that as a whole grain bagel and too much rice?
Absolutely. When someone comes to me, we talk about whether or not they have the parameters of metabolic syndrome, or even if they have only high triglycerides, because I think what that helps to show is that they have some increased sensitivity to starches and carbohydrates. And in that place, I believe that you can replace that with healthy fats, avocados, olives, coconut. And those patients, you can get them to do much better.
Mm-hmm.
So I do try to, I do screen for that. We do talk about that. And there are people that I absolutely try to recommend that we try something else. The other thing that sometimes will work for people who seem to be wheat sensitive or gluten sensitive is to try them on, to try to convert them over to gluten-free type grain, whole grain.
Right.
Quinoa, amaranth, teff, millet. And people are very open to that. They just oftentimes haven't heard about that or know how to work with that. But once you train them and help them, they're usually very open to making the switch. And find out that they, that weight, that 10 or 15 pounds, 7 pounds that got stuck on there, now comes off much easier.
What is your take on the new recommendations for blood pressure control that were the outcome of a recent study that showed that even tighter blood pressure control could help to avert incidents of disease and save lives? It's kind of like blood pressure limbo. How low can you go? I mean, what is a good blood pressure? How drastically do you want to reduce blood pressure? And, you know, if you can't get it below a certain level, should you put patients on medications?
Well, you know, I think it was from the SPRINT trial that came out recently.
Right.
And the SPRINT trial looked at older individuals. And the teaching was that if you could get them to 140 or 90, you were probably doing pretty well. And in the latest JNC 8, they actually had for older individuals a new target of 150 systolic.
And that may be because there are some deleterious effects, especially in elderly individuals, of too aggressive blood pressure control, correct?
Well, what even SPRINT found was that when you really tried to push at some of these people, there was a significant, it was low, but it was still significant over the aggressive treatment group over the non-aggressive treatment group. There was a significant but low increase in acute kidney injury, syncope, which is passing out. And so that became an issue, especially the acute kidney injury.
Right.
There has always been the teaching about what's called a J-curve, is that people do better from a cardiovascular or a heart standpoint as you lower blood pressure to a certain level, which was thought to be somewhere around 115 to 120 over 80. And then when you started to push below that, you actually saw the risk of morbidity and mortality start to rise again, mm-hmm. slightly, hence the J. This sort of puts that in question as to where that J point is, where the curve is going to be, and who you try to lower blood pressure on. You know, the teaching has always been if you have congestive heart failure, if you have chronic kidney disease.
Or perhaps if you've had a stroke or something like that.
A stroke, a myocardial infarction. These are the people that you really want to try to lower down into a more 120 to 130 over 80 kind of range.
So in other words, with blood pressure, it's not a one-size-fits-all. I think people kind of are hung up on this 120 over 90 model, or, you know, 120 over 80 model, where it is thought that that's where everyone should be. But that may or may not be suitable for everyone.
No, I think it has to be individualized to the patient, especially to the older individual. A number of older individuals will have what we call a widened pulse pressure. And so what you'll see is that the difference between the top number, the systolic mm-hmm. blood pressure, and the bottom number, the diastolic blood pressure, is very large.
Right, like 150 and, over 70 or something like that.
Oh, larger than that.
Even larger,
so
okay.
So go 150, 160 over 50 to 60.
Wow, okay.
And when you see that, you know, start to approach 80, 90, 100, what you can know about that is that those people have lost what we call the distensibility, or the stretchiness, the give in the arterial system.
So they truly have people, hardening of the arteries. That's precisely the definition of hardening of the arteries.
And those are the people that you sometimes get into trouble with when you try to aggressively lower the systolic blood pressure. They'll get dizzy, they'll pass out. They won't get appropriate perfusion to the kidney, and they'll get some kidney dysfunction. And I think that's the kind of question that Sprint has raised. Okay, so who does this work on? Who doesn't this work on? Should we take these people separately and trial them? And a lot of the work, I think, from Sprint came out of the fact that if you look at the trials in older people that had come before it, there was the systolic hypertension in the elderly population 1 and 2. There were the Veterans Administration trials. A lot of these trials had subgroups or ward distinctly for older individuals. And the goal was always to try to get them to less than 140 over 90. Mm-hmm. But no one really did. When you go back and look at those trials, by and large, they lowered people's blood pressure about 15 to 20 millimeters of mercury, but most of the time did not reach goal less than 140 over 90. So Sprint was a real attempt to try to get them below that 140 over 90, knowing that the historical significance was we've never done it. So when the new JNC 8 came out, they went back and they looked at all this prior data and said, well, you know, we never really got older individuals down to less than 140 over 90 anyway, but we reduce the risk of stroke, and we reduce the risk of heart attack, and we reduce the risk of death. We'll put the new parameter at 150. And then Sprint came out. So I think it was 2013, the JMCA came out, and now this year Sprint came out. So they're kind of backpedaling a little bit. I think it's just raised a little more new questions.
Right. Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the pitfalls of medicine these days is that doctors apply algorithms, and they sometimes forget about individuals. They, you know, say, you know, your cholesterol should be this, your blood pressure should be that, your blood sugar should be this. And then they fire away with sometimes powerful medications with potential side effects to achieve those goals, perhaps to the detriment of patients. You know, unfortunately, not considering lifestyle measures that would make all those things better.
I think you're absolutely correct. I think the most important thing to remember is that these are population studies. So they look at very large populations of individuals. And when you try to generalize from a population to a specific patient, that patient may or may not fit into that population perfectly, into that population study. And you have to take the nuances of the patient into consideration. And I think that's a lot of the art of medicine. You know, people think of medicine as a science, but it's really an art and a science. And that's part of the art, is looking at your patient and saying, okay, I think this will work this far, but maybe not as far as they pushed it in the study because we have all these other side effects and we have all these other issues.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's really very important not to lose sight of that.
Absolutely. So what are some of your favorite supplements in your armamentarium against hypertension?
Well, I'm a very big fan of fiber.
Fiber,
I'm not
okay.
sure if you would absolutely.
Okay.
I think fiber is wonderful. It can show a significant reduction in systolic and diastolic blood pressures.
You know, come to think of it, you've never seen a hypertensive moth. So I guess that's proof positive that fiber, you know, is good for you.
Absolutely. If you can get people to get up, you know, into that 25-35 grams a day of fiber, they can sometimes have as much as a 9-10 millimeter reduction in systolic blood pressure.
And why do you think that is? Do you think that's because that precludes their intake of more food and makes them lose weight? Or do you think there's a microbiome effect that it somehow alters the intestinal environment? And we know that that's so important for metabolism.
I think it serves to affect the intestinal microbiome. I think you're absolutely correct about that. And that's a key factor in total systemic inflammation. I believe that's part of it. I believe also, you know, that it's part of it, that it helps to shuttle out some of the other toxins in the body that can lead to inflammation. And I think it fills people up is another issue and makes them less likely to take in more inflammatory type foods.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it comes back again to how do we reduce systemic inflammation. Another great supplement that I love that I think is really very helpful is magnesium. And I will try to get people on a magnesium glycinate, which is usually a little bit easier on the stomach. And that's been shown to have a very significant decrease in high blood pressure for people. It's also very beneficial if you have, especially if you have a woman who has migraine headaches. You can get rid of two birds with one stone. Basically, it helps if women have dysmenorrhea and some preeclampsia symptoms. Dysmenorrhea,
mm-hmm.
And premenstrual symptoms. So I think it's really a very useful supplement.
Mm-hmm.
I also think coenzyme Q10 is extremely useful, especially for people who are also on a statin, because as we know, statins can lead to mitochondrial dysfunction, increased generation of free radicals, and there were some pretty decent studies done that showed that you can get some pretty decent reduction in blood pressure on a coenzyme Q10, and they were supplemented with anywhere from 75 to 360 milligrams a day, depending on what study you looked at. The other thing that's helpful is if you have any type of heart failure, with a high blood pressure, I think coenzyme Q10 is imperative for you. There was a wonderful randomized double-blind trial. They used coenzyme Q10 and had about a 16 millimeter decrease in blood pressure at 200 milligrams a day. So I think that's pretty, I think that's pretty beneficial. So I try to get patients on coenzyme Q10. The only concern is the coenzyme Q10 can theoretically have an antiplatelet effect, so you have to be a little bit careful with that.
Like a vitamin K like effect, you're thinking?
No, more like
a blood thinning effect. A blood thinning.
Yes.
Okay.
Or an anticoagulant. And the other issue about it is that it does have excretion through the bile. So if you have somebody with hepatic impairment or biliary obstruction, that becomes another
Something to look for. Vitamin D. Are you convinced that vitamin D is part of the picture here with hypertension? Because there are some studies that link vitamin D deficiency to hypertension. Is that a part of your therapeutic armamentarium?
I screen everyone for vitamin D deficiency, absolutely. The health professional follow-up study and the nurse's health study both showed that low vitamin D status showed an increased risk of hypertension over a 4 to 8 year period. There was also the Intermountain Heart Collaborative study, and that looked actually at about 40,000 people. And those people who had vitamin D less than 30 nanograms per milliliter had a significant risk and prevalence of high blood pressure. Now, what's been a little more difficult to show is that if you supplement people,
right,
that you will get a substantial reduction in hypertension. So that's been a little more difficult to show. But I truly believe that you need at least a level of 40 and probably somewhere between 40 and 80 for vitamin D. So I do supplement people, and I think it's imperative, especially in Northeast Ohio, because between now, November, and April, there's not a whole lot of sunshine up here.
It's pretty dark there.
Pretty dark.
What about the effects of stress? Because, hypertension, is it related to stress to some extent?
Absolutely. It absolutely is. There's good literature to support the use of mind-body and biofeedback. There's the respirate biofeedback system that's actually been FDA approved, which does, breathing, teaching you about breathing and about stress and letting you see how it can lower your pressures. I think there's a definite connection to that. It's also, blood pressure is very much affected by the flight or fright system of the body, the adrenal and the adrenal hormones. And if you can generate a relaxation response, you can stimulate the part of the autonomic nervous system called the parasympathetic nervous system. And when you can do that and teach people how to do that, you can help them significantly lower blood pressure. There are studies for yoga that have shown reductions in blood pressure. There are studies for Qigong. Transcendental meditation has studies. Tai Chi has studies. And Tai Chi also has great studies on balance control for older individuals, as well as helping with falls. So sometimes you can get a number of things accomplished with one physical modality.
And speaking of
big fan of that.
And speaking of a modality that pulls a lot of things together, exercise. What did the study show about exercise?
exercise, if you look in the primer for hypertension or Kaplan, they will tell you minimum of 30 minutes five times a week. You want 150 minutes a week, and that's been shown to reduce blood pressure 5 to 7 millimeters of mercury on the top number.
That's comparable to many drugs. I mean, if a drug were trialed in by the FDA and went through phase 2, 3, 4, and finally came for approval with the FDA, a 5 to 7% reduction in blood pressure would make it a multi-billion dollar drug. It would be
If they could bottle it and sell it, you got that. Absolutely. Yeah. And one of the best things about exercise is that there are studies that have shown that the response to exercise can last up to 22 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a substantial effect. If you do it day to day to day, it does actually build up for you. So I try to get everybody on something. And I think you have to find the type of exercise.
Will walking suffice? Because for some people, perhaps they're, couch potatoes, they're not used to going to the gym, heavy-duty exertion. Is that adequate?
Absolutely. If you can walk at a moderate pace, absolutely. If you can't walk, you can bike. If you can't bike, you can swim. You can, whatever you can do. If you want to use an elliptical, you can use an elliptical. I have a number of people, obviously, who are overweight, and they tell me, oh, dog, I can't walk. I have too much arthritis in my knees.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a bike, also my bike, if you want. And I say, fine. It's just getting people moving. And even to try to just incorporate more physical activity into the day in any way you can do that. You don't look for the closest parking spot at the mall. You look for the farthest parking spot at the mall. Instead of taking your laundry up all at once, you take one load at a time up and down the stairs. So oftentimes I'll just try to get people to move more in a day. And that's where we start.
Well, that sounds like a prescription that we all can follow. What's today's intelligent medicine call to action? What are some of the resources that people should be accessing if they have high blood pressure or perhaps if they want to pay you a visit?
Well, I think one of the biggest things, if you have high blood pressure, I think knowing your blood pressure number is imperative. It's like if you have diabetes, you need to know your blood sugar. You can't control something that you can't see. So the one call to action, I think, is absolutely to, if you have high blood pressure and you don't have a high blood pressure cuff, get one.
And are those electronic cuffs good, in your opinion?
They're automated. An Omron upper arm automated blood pressure cuff is absolutely fine. You can buy them at just about any drugstore. You can buy them at most discount retailer pharmacies. They're just about everywhere.
What about the wrist kind or the finger kind? Are they now they have things where you just kind of apply your cell phone receiver to your wrist or something like that, and it supposedly has an algorithm that calculates your blood pressure. Is that going to do the
trick?
I
don't think the technology for the cell phone has come around well enough. The wrist ones and especially the finger ones are pretty unreliable.
Okay.
So if you're really trying to treat this and get it under control, you need an upper arm cuff. The next most important thing, I think, is that you start to make those dietary changes that you can find in a Mediterranean diet or that you find in the DASH diet. And that you just start to get moving, and finally that you find some sort of stress relaxation, whether you use the Respirate system, whether you use heart math, whether you use meditation, breathing, even focused prayer will work. Any one of those things that helps to relieve stress and helps to refocus you away from anxiety will help you out.
How about details on your practice, the website and information?
You can contact me through my website, the Center for Lifestyle Change. You can also email me at drkathy@tc4lc.com. And the phone number at the center is 888-565-6754.
Your practice is not just restricted to inhabitants of northeastern Ohio. You're a destination practice because this is your forte for people with challenging blood pressure problems.
Absolutely. Okay. I would be more than happy to try to help anyone who would like some help.
Well, great. I think you've given us there's a lot to discuss in this, and, you know, we could revisit you for some more details, but you've given us a very comprehensive introduction to the subject of high blood pressure and ways of treating it. So I want to thank you very much, and congratulations on your hyper-focus on this very, very important problem. Dr. Kathy Padgett, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Hoffman. I enjoyed our time together.
By the way, spelling is PADGITT. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.